Good evening. Welcome to the second evening of our lecture series, Sal U, Storyteller Uprising. This is a co-presentation of Seattle Arts and Lectures and the Department of Communication. My name is Rebecca Hoogs, and I'm the Director of Education for Seattle Arts and Lectures. I have been working with the Department of Communication to put this program together, and I'm really delighted that you're all here, that you made it through the snow. Hooray for you, the proud, the few, the brave. It's a real delight to welcome back the ever-popular and dynamic and engaging speaker, Professor Domke. I know you are all very excited to hear what he has to say tonight, so please join me in welcoming Professor Domke.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. So it's a pleasure to come and do a Seattle Arts and Lectures lecture. I've had a privilege to do a few in the past, and I always enjoy the kind of energy and dynamic that goes into these. And you're already breaking barriers by coming out tonight and cutting through. Hopefully someone's got a snowplow so we can get out of here tonight. Okay. Egypt's got nothing on us if you can come out tonight, right, in terms of the courage that you're displaying. So I'd like to kind of set up the lecture series as I see it and put my place into it and then jump into some of the things I want to talk about. So I'm the chair of the Department of Communication at the University of Washington, and my research focuses mostly on politics and news and the effects of political messages and news coverage on public opinion in the United States. So I'm really interested in how these two very important social entities, politicians and political parties, and news organizations, influence the public generally in the United States. In that process, people who do the kind of research who do similar kind of research to what I do, have been increasingly arguing for the last 10 years or so that the internet is fundamentally changing our political institutions, fundamentally changing how we politically engage, changing how news media try to talk to the world. And there's no doubt that there's considerable evidence that this is so. Where I've kind of struggled in this process a little bit is to put my finger on necessarily some tangible implications. So certainly I can go online and get news whenever I want, or I can find out what's going on around the world, or I can go to a website of a candidate. But I've been kind of struggling to think about what are the very tangible ways that I as a citizen might be affected, might be changed. Am I actually impacted by this at all in some kind of tangible way? So the context for the lecture series is that there's five people giving lectures in this lecture series, and I'm the least technological cheerleader out of them all. Okay, I'm the least. I'm not a Luddite by any means. I've got my smartphone over here. Okay, but I'm not someone who lives necessarily in the kind of digital media world. And so what's going to happen tonight is I'm going to make an argument that is partly an argument I believe, and is also partly an argument that I'm kind of starting to believe, and I'm just kind of want to run it past you and see what you think, okay? But when I make an argument, I kind of go all in, all right? So I'll try to give it to you with the best kind of strength to it. Thank you so much. So what you got if you came to the first lecture was Hanson Hossain, who's just a media savant and knows everything and has got every gadget you can imagine. And just brilliant, always on the cutting edge, knows what's going on. And then you go to me, and so I'm kind of the other end of the spectrum, not the Luddite, but someone who when I lecture in rooms this large regularly on this campus for classrooms, and I use overheads. I use overheads. So I don't use PowerPoint when I do talks, when I teach. I do them for lectures. But I don't do them when I teach because I think students just kind of check out. And it's okay if you check out. You paid for this, all right? But my students, they need to kind of take that exam, right? And then the next three folks that come into this lecture series are going to talk about specific applications of some of the digital media implications in our society, globally and in the United States. Some legal issues, some community partnerships that exist between organizations, such as the UW, but many others, and community groups. And then also looking at the role of digital media in emerging markets overseas, and also perhaps domestically. I don't really know what you're going to talk about, Anita, but it'll be really good, I'm sure, okay? And the key to this is that the five folks that are going to talk to you, they're all going to say something that I think is interesting. And all five of them are going to have slightly different perspectives on this. And our goal was to put together kind of a broader narrative. It's a storyteller uprising, a broader narrative to this whole piece in which Hanson Hossain lays out this big picture. I come in with a little bit of skepticism, but with some argument, with some information that I'm getting concretely convinced about, and then three others will come in with some really pertinent pieces that kind of flesh out the picture. So what I want to do tonight is talk about a citizenship revolution. And, you know, I came up with the title for this talk about a month and a half ago, knowing, of course, that the timing of this would be that there would be literally revolutions going on. And, I mean, this is the kind of skill it takes to be a chair, a department chair, okay? But mostly I came up with this because I'm a little skeptical. And people keep telling me there are revolutions going on with digital media, and I keep saying, yeah, I know my students are texting all the time, and I know that they're iPodding all the time and all this stuff, but show me the revolution. Well, a little bit of it's here, I think. But the title also is, of course, the reference to the Beatles, and in that song, the Revolution song, they talk about the pain that comes with a revolution. And so we say we want a revolution, but do you really want a revolution? Because it's much easier to read about a revolution than it is to be in a revolution, right? So that's kind of the context for this talk. Most of my talk tonight will focus on the United States, because that's the area that I know best when it comes to kind of politics and media and public discussion. But there are implications for the broader context for social media. So let me start here with a citizenship revolution. I don't mean a definition of citizenship, what it means to be a citizen. For example, we have a discussion about what it means to be a citizen in the United States today. Are you born in the United States? Does that make you a citizen? Well, that's been the case for about 150 years. Is that going to still be the case? I don't know. We'll see. That's a discussion about the legal implications of how do you become a citizen. I'm not really that interested in that tonight. What I'm interested in is the kind of civic meaning of what it means to be a citizen. What does it mean to claim I'm a citizen of the United States, or I'm a citizen of Egypt, or I'm a citizen of somewhere? What does that mean in terms of the norms and expectations of growing up and participating in that society? So I want to talk about a citizenship revolution, what it means to be a citizen. How do we go through life? What are the expectations that we have put upon us and that we also cast? Now, some places where we think about this, though, when we think about a kind of revolution or media revolution, we go to somebody like this, Mark Zuckerberg, whose 30th birthday will be 3 years from now, okay? Someone who named Person of the Year by Time, by far the youngest person they've ever put on their cover for Person of the Year, and is, you know, supposedly this person who's changing the world through the creation of Facebook, okay? Well, then we have a person in Tunisia who puts up kind of the sign of the day, who's afraid of Twitter, because, of course, implied in this is the notion that the only people afraid of Twitter are despots, are dictators, right? Who else would ever be afraid of Twitter? Actually, in this room, there might be a few of you that are afraid of Twitter, okay? So it's the question of the day, though, that the idea that like Twitter is the one that's driving this revolution or these revolutions. Then there's this guy in Egypt. Okay, so I'm about to have a little question and answer with you right now, okay? So everybody, who knows what the E stands for? Internet Explorer, okay, good. The G is what? Google, okay. The Y is what? We'll skip the P for a second. The T is what? Twitter. Okay, anybody know what the P is? PayPal? I don't think it is, okay? But I was spending some time looking for what the P is, and apparently nobody knows what the P is, okay? So my guess, my best guess, and with my own informant who knows this stuff very well, is that it's a social media kind of service somewhere in the Middle East that is relevant. But I looked across a number of sites and nobody knew what the P is. They were guessing, people who are in the know on this stuff. So it might just have been made up. That would be the way, you know, you might do this if you're going to make the sign, right? And then some company will come along and build their logo around this and they'll become, this will be huge. So, but there's one other thing that I just want to end this opening little set of pictures with. And then there's this, okay? That if you go to YouTube and you click in Egypt, Wisconsin unions, you'll get a video made by a leader of a series of private unions in Egypt sending a message to Wisconsin public unions saying, you stood with us, we stand with you. Okay? So this is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. Just, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the notion that people in these different locales would talk to each other, even care about what's going on with each other, that's just truly revolutionary. That is revolutionary. That's amazing. Okay? And I mean, you see the flags in the background. That's not Madison, Wisconsin. Okay? All right. So I want to start formally here with talking about media technologies with the kind of uber media theorist, the person that everybody quotes when they want to kind of make the argument that the media are taking over the world, is Marshall McLuhan, right? And so McLuhan, who it's important to recognize, I talked with my students about this, that McLuhan was Canadian, all right? And he was fundamentally interested in how it was that the grand media giant that was the United States was imposing these kind of its cultural will around the world, particularly on Canada, but around the world. And his argument was that, you know, media were at the center of this. And so I think the fact that McLuhan was not American, I think, gave him some unique insights on the impact of American media. And so McLuhan said a lot of really interesting things, but I just want to bring you one quote right here to start us off with. He said, in 1969, in a Playboy interview, effective study of the media deals not only with the content of the media, but with the media themselves and the total cultural environment within which the media function. Only by standing aside from any phenomenon and taking an overview can you discover its operative principles and lines of force. There's really nothing inherently startling or radical about this study, except that for some reason few have had the vision to undertake it. Now there's a little self-aggrandizing in this, right? Saying like, few are as smart as I am, but, you know, I mean, this is what McLuhan was not a humble dude, okay? For the past 3,500 years of the Western world, the effects of media, whether it's speech, writing, printing, photography, radio, or television, have been systematically overlooked by social observers. I think that's a little bit of an overstatement, but it's still, he's making a point here. Most people are still blissfully ignorant of what the media do to them, unaware that the medium is also the message, that, all puns aside, it literally works over and saturates and molds and transforms every sense ratio. The content or message of any particular medium has about as much importance as the stenciling on the casing of an atomic bomb. By stressing that the medium is the message rather than the content, I'm not suggesting that content plays no role, merely that it plays a distinctly subordinate role. In placing all of the stress on content and practically none on the medium, we lose all chance of perceiving and influencing the impact. We lose all chance of perceiving, that's important, but also and influencing the impact of new technologies on man. And thus, we're always dumbfounded by and unprepared for the revolutionary environmental transformations induced by new media. And this is a comment that I take directly to heart because in my research and in my teaching, I'm 99% focused on content. 99% focused on the messages that we see. Are they sexual? Are they political? Are they racial? Are they pro-America? Are they critical of America? Are they pro-marriage? What are they? I'm interested in the content. And what McLuhan would say is you're just missing the boat, by and large. That content's relevant, but you're missing the delivery mechanisms, the channels, the silos within which this information comes. And so I thought tonight I'd try this on for size as a viewpoint. I try it on and see how it fits, how it feels. And it's always kind of fun to go kind of all in. I think I want to be a futurist if I come back in another life. I want to be someone that just says outrageous things about the future that nobody can prove yes or no at the time. And so you just walk around saying great things and get paid a lot of money to say these kinds of things, right? So McLuhan was brilliant. A lot of stuff that he said, it seems to be coming true. And so I thought I'd try on this argument. So here's what I want to do is I want to go with a little timeline here. And the great thing about a PowerPoint slide is you can put a lot of time on one slide. So we're going to go from 1400 to the early 2000s in one slide. And what I want to do is I've placed a series of technologies on this timeline from the printing press, which is created over a series of time, but really becomes kind of pegged in the mid 1400s, all the way to recent. So I'm just going to put these up there. We'll see them, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about them. Now, when I talk about technologies, I'm really fundamentally interested in media technologies. There's a lot of other technologies out there, but I'm fundamentally interested in media technologies. And I don't consider the internet, for example, a technology. It is something that you use via computers, the technology or computers, or via smartphones. So I'm really interested in the new media technologies, the new tools that have been created over time. So let me just kind of run through these fairly quickly and then talk a bit about kind of why some are above the line and why some are below the line. So the printing press gets created in the 1400s and becomes a people are fairly comfortable saying it's a revolutionary moment. Knowledge and information begins to disseminate among the masses. Literacy begins to expand. All knowledge is no longer sustained supposedly in the church or in political leadership. So it's a technology that opens up knowledge to be produced by many different people, produced and received by many different people who previously did not have that ability to do that. So we might call it a democratizing technology. Okay? A democratizing technology. Well, it goes a long time till you get the next really major technology along the way. And you go all the way to telegraphy in the mid-1800s, and these, again, take some decades to develop, but kind of peg it as getting mass coming into the mass consciousness in the mid-1800s. And telegraphy, the telegraph, originally used by institutions and by government, but then expanded well beyond that and began to be used by all kinds of organizations and social causes. In fact, there's a really fascinating book called The Victorian Internet, which talks about the telegraph as the forerunner of what we now know of the social networks that are fueled by the internet. That the telegraph produced the same kind of dynamic in a global capacity for the day at the time. So I'll call this a democratizing medium as well. It opened up the production and the dissemination and the reception of information and knowledge to more people. Photography, similar kind of thing. People learned to be able to take pictures, to disseminate those pictures, to send them around the world. So we have this ability for the creation of knowledge and information through photographs and to distribute those through that technology. We then come down below the line, and we have three that come along pretty quickly together: radio, film, and television. And radio, film, and television get their births largely in the United States, and they get quickly adopted by mass commercial media outlets. They become commercial entities. They start out as education entities, and then they become commercial entities, and they become money-making entertainment vehicles, and they have the first two of these have their grand glory, their golden years in the middle of the Depression because they're cheap entertainment for people. And television comes along and kind of usurps them and immediately cuts and just decimates the film audience for some time. And radio has to figure out what to do. All of the radio networks quickly move over to television. So these three are they're very closely linked. They're commercial entities. They're controlled by very large organizations. There are one-way conduits of information. They're in the business of making a great deal of money. They're very different than the ones above the line. We had 5 film studios within 6 years of the beginning of film in this country, and today we have 6 film studios because the costs are so high that you cannot challenge these. Okay? So the massive power, the amount of money, the creation of knowledge and information is controlled and dealt with in a very different way for those three than the ones above the line. Then we come back in recent years to the creation of the personal computer, which takes these large mainframes and puts them in people's homes, and opens up a whole can of knowledge creation that that had never been located at the fingertips of people. And then we have the extension of these with smartphones, which is a small computer. The creation of a computer in my hand, the ability to go online, to send text, to do all these things right from the palm of my hand. When I look at this history, when I look at this timeline, I'm intrigued by 2 things. One is how democratizing those 5 above the line are, in that they allow the creation, so the production, the dissemination, and the reception of knowledge and information to be spun out among the masses in a much greater way. I'm struck by that, and I'm struck by how, I don't know if I would say anti-democratic or autocratic, the 3 below the line are. They are not about democratizing information and knowledge. They are primarily about a money-making venture that does not put power and information and knowledge in the hands of the few. So what we have been fixated on, I think, in the United States has been the sense that, wow, suddenly we have these democratizing media. And I think that's not a suddenly. I think that's actually been the norm. I think that's been the norm for most of these technologies. And I think the reality is that these 3 below the line have completely dominated our senses of what are technologies, of how they function in our society, that we have been raised with them, we understand them, and we sit passively in front of them by and large, that we are missing the boat in recognizing that actually those are the 3 that are the aberration in this process. Those are the 3 that are different than the others. Which ones are not like the others? I think those ones are not like the others. I think the other ones are the norm, in that technology generally, media technologies generally democratize information and knowledge. But that's hard for us, particularly in a Western society, particularly in the United States, in which television penetration in households in the United States is at about 99% of households have at least 1 television. 94% of American households have a toilet. So you have people are more likely to have a television than a toilet. And many, many homes have far more than 1 television. Okay? So I'm intrigued by this. I'm intrigued by the fact that maybe technologies tend to be more democratizing, and what we've had is 3 that have dominated our consciousness in a way that isn't. And so we're struck by this newness when in reality it's not. It's like an old story. Okay? So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's look at some of the characteristics of these technologies, particularly these recent technologies. Because there's one other thing that I think is interesting about those 2 most recent technologies, the personal computers and the smartphones, is that, remember, I'm trying this argument out on you today. So I don't have it all firmly in my mind. This is a key point right now. What I'm about to say is huge, okay? That when you look back at this, so I made the argument that stuff above the line is different than the stuff below the line, and that's more normal, quote-unquote normal. But the one thing I want to suggest is that the last 2, the smartphones and the personal computers, are different than the first 3 in one important way, in that they skew to a greater embrace among young people. They are more prevalent among younger people than older people. People who are 18 weren't carrying around a printing press. Okay? People didn't have cameras when they were teenagers in the 1850s. So what we've got is democratizing technologies generally, and we've got some now that skew younger and are creating generational divides and differences, and also are fueling, I think, this sense of how it can be revolutionary, these technologies can be revolutionary. So I think that distinction to me is quite intriguing. So let me then look at a couple technologies to see how they play out in the American population. Who owns these? Who owns these? A smartphone, a smartphone by definition is a phone that can go online and connect to others in a networked fashion at any time other than just through a phone call. So it's got the capacity beyond a phone call. Let's see how many people own, what's a smartphone? A BlackBerry is a smartphone. An iPhone is a smartphone, or the Android, which I have, that's a smartphone. I'm not real pleased with it right now, but it's all right. So who owns these? Well, let's look at an age breakdown. This is all Pew data from about 3 months ago. And we'll start over here from older to younger, broken down by Pew's age breakdowns. And we'll just see what percent of the public owns smartphones. Okay? So it skews younger. But the tipping point doesn't seem to be 18. The tipping point is somewhere in here. Okay? But it's a technology that skews younger. Okay? All right? What about laptops? What about the creation of laptops? I think the most powerful technologies in the world, media technologies, are smartphones and laptops right now. If you give me those, I'd be happy to go over to the Middle East and chronicle what's going on, or up to Wisconsin to see what's going on. I just need those two things. That's all I need. My wife and I have been married for 20 years, and we're going to take a big trip to Italy. I want to go to Israel because I want to go like where things are happening, right? I'm not going to force her to go to Egypt, but like maybe Israel. It's like kind of close, okay? And there's a lot of human history a little bit there. And so I want to go, and she's like, no, it's not safe there. I was like, but really there's this part of me it just wants to go where things are happening, and all I really want to take is my laptop. I just want to go and write about what I'm seeing. I just want to go take some photographs and do this. Laptops are an incredibly powerful thing for people, creation and production and dissemination of knowledge. Well, who owns these things? Okay, let's see. Laptops, they skew younger. Now, what's interesting about computers is if I ran this figure for desktops, It looks like a bell curve, okay? Because they've got that data too. But if you run it for laptops, it looks like this. And a laptop is like the difference between a Porsche and a Camry, all right? In terms of, I think, effective change technology. All right, what about one more? iPads or tablets? Now, these have only been around for about 6 or 7 months. So the percentages on the left side are much smaller. But who owns these things? Who owns these things? Well, again, it skews young. Okay? Now, for anybody who's wondering about e-readers, you'll be happy to know that they do. E-readers are not in this category. They skew a little bit higher among older folks. So that's the one technology that skews a little bit higher among people who are over 50. But so we take these three, what I would argue are the most potent most potent digital technologies that we have available right now. Smartphone, a laptop, and the iPad or tablets generally. And they all skew younger in the United States. Okay, that's really interesting to me because these things do cost money. They cost money. They also require knowledge to operate. I don't know if you've noticed this, but I had dinner with a colleague tonight, and I needed her to show me how to operate the clock on my phone, right? And she messed it up. But, you know, the reality is that this takes a lot of knowledge. I'm probably using less than 1% of the power of my phone because it takes time, right? So it takes knowledge, it takes money, and yet young people are the ones that are doing this. So as democratizing as all those technologies might have been for much of human history, the ones above the line, I think we've got now some at our disposal which are not only democratizing, they also put power into the hands of younger people in a way that's never been the case. Okay? And it surely scares people that aren't in that cohort because they just, it's, you know, you're on Mr. Toad's wild ride and you're not really sure you want to be on this, but you know you probably, it's kind of fun on one hand, but then you just don't know where it's going. So, I'm intrigued by this. So what I want to talk about is a citizenship revolution. So here's what I do. So here's the chronology, here's the narrative of this talk. I'm a skeptic, but I'm kind of trying to persuade myself, and partly I'm persuaded by the power of these technologies and the importance of what's going on with them. So I'm moving along in my narrative, and so now I come to a place where I have to wrestle with the fact that, okay, these are democratizing, but they maybe skew younger in a different way. So what's going on with that? This is perfect, because now we get into the sweet spot of the research that I do. We do get into the area in which I spend a lot of time thinking about things. And one of the areas that I do work on is trying to understand what it is, how it is that people define what it means to be a citizen. What does it mean to be a citizen? Again, not legally, but culturally. What does it mean to be a citizen? And so I have a colleague in my department, in the communication department, Lance Bennett, who also spends a lot of time thinking about this. So Lance and I have these really great conversations about what it means to be civically engaged and to talk about the different possibilities of how it is that one enacts being a citizen. And so I want to suggest that there's a couple frameworks that might be useful for us to think about this. So I'm going to go back to McLuhan here for a moment, and I'm going to say that, use this quote from him in 1955 when television is just arriving on the scene in the United States in a mass way. Television gets FCC licensing in 1953. It gets big play throughout the 50s. And he says it's the framework which changes with each new technology and not just the picture within the frame. And it's that framework around it that I think he speaks to in that first quote I gave you of standing aside a phenomenon and being able to see things. In the same way that we can look at Egypt today and say, wow, that's a revolution. Or we can stand in Washington, say in Wisconsin, well, that's pretty dramatic what's going on there. But the reality is when you're in the midst of it, you have a different picture, a different view. You're in the picture. So the ability to stand outside of it is kind of what he's going for, that the frame changes, the broader frame changes. So I want to offer two frameworks that I think are in tension with one another for how we be citizens. How it is that we are citizens, how it is that we engage as citizens. And I think these are distinctly tied to technology. I'm not going to go so far as to say they're driven by technology. Not comfortable using that verb. When I work with my students, I talk about the importance of verbs. Does something cause something? Is something a result of something? Is something related to something? Well, I'm not going to use a causal verb and say that this is being driven or caused by technology. However, I think technology is catalyzing this. Okay, technology is helping to catalyze this distinction that I want to talk about. And it's in tension with one another. Okay, so two models of citizenship. One that has dominated American public arena for the last 70 years and one that is now challenging it. The dutiful model is the model of the greatest generation in the United States. It's the model that people raised in the Depression, who fought in wars, who went through the Cold War, have experienced the 60s but were not the baby boomers, have gone through. It's the greatest generation, roughly. The relational model is roughly the millennial generation. It's folks who've been raised in affluence, largely, in the United States, came of age personally and intellectually in the 1980s and 90s, people who've been raised with television as a parent, and have also, but have adapted fairly quickly to the internet environment. Okay? So they're really two different groups of people, and I know because I'm right in the middle of these two. I exist in the tension between these two, and my students are almost all relational. Okay, so I love them. I love them very much, my students, but I don't always understand them. So I want to talk a little bit about on five different characteristics how these two models of citizenship differ and relate to one another on these characteristics. Okay, first thing. A dutiful model, the primary way of going through life is a sense of obligation and responsibility. You're nodding as if you know this already. It's like the Catholicism of citizenship, right? And I was raised Catholic, so I have the license to say this. So this sense of guilt and obligation, right? So that you should be at Mass, or you should be doing these different things. Oh, thank you. This sense of responsibility. That's the primary kind of sensibility. You owe it to those who came before you. This relational citizen just does not experience the world that way. They do not. They do not live under the cloud, the burden. They live in the world in which is much more selective. They have a sense of selectivity to their everyday existence. And this troubles the dutiful citizen to no end, the sense of selectivity. The relational, the dutiful citizen says, quite often, you should do that. And the relational citizen says, don't should on me. I'll do it if I want to do it. Now, that is an incredibly privileged, affluent space to be able to say that. Incredibly privileged and affluent. But that's what the United States has become for millions and millions of people in the last couple decades, is this incredibly wealthy, remarkably affluent space for so many millions of Americans. Not all, of course not. But it has become far more normative now to have the means to do a lot of things that were just used to be the province of the wealthier folks in our society. So the dutiful citizen says, it's not a selectivity. You don't choose to do things or not. You do them. And the relational citizen says, you know, I'm sorry, but the reality is that you gave me choices, and I'm going to now exercise them. Okay? And if the relational citizen did a better job of saying thank you as well, it would help. But they don't. So the relational citizen just says, I'm going to make my choices. So what you start out with is two fundamentally different paradigms. For the dutiful citizen, you wake up in the morning with a sense of responsibility and obligation. For the relational citizen, you wake up in the world with the Microsoft slogan of where do you want to go today? Okay, where do you want to go today? What do you want to do today? What an incredibly privileged space that is. And between the two, there's a deep gulf. Okay, so some of the work that I do is bringing generations together and having them talk to each other about this gulf, because it's quite a divide. Okay, so that's one point of differentiation between the two kind of mindsets, two mindsets of what it means to be a citizen. A second distinction is that the dutiful citizen primarily sees citizenship as a set of formal activities: voting, joining political parties, giving money, being a member of an organization. In my hometown where I grew up, we had the Moose Club, and so people joined the Moose, or you got the Elks or the Shriners. Well, none of my students know who any of these folks are, right? They don't know who any of them. So it's a set of formal activities. The relational citizen has a very different view of the world. They see citizenship as a set of everyday activities, not a set of formal activities, but a set of everyday activities. So the difference between these two is that the dutiful citizen is epitomized in the League of Women Voters. That is that the key thing as a citizen is to vote. It's a formal activity. The everyday citizen lives out their citizenship in a life set of lifestyle choices. What kind of car will I drive? What kind of diapers will I buy for my child? What kind of clothes will I wear? What kind of food will I eat? You know, I don't know if you've seen the television series Portlandia. Well, it's too funky for me, but I watched like 20 minutes of it, and the scene that I saw that I found very funny was this couple goes into this restaurant in Portland, and they're going to have a chicken, and they say, well, what's the chicken about? And the person starts telling them, well, it was raised on a 4-acre farm, and it was, you know, and all this. And they need to know more. They need to know more. And so the waitress says, I'll be back. And she comes back with, and she's got a little bio on the chicken. And the chicken's name, she goes, well, his name is Frank or something like this. And so it's a set of everyday activities, and it's a wonderful thing. But there's a real disjuncture here. The dutiful citizen says none of those everyday activities matter if you don't vote. And the relational citizen says it doesn't matter if you vote if you don't do those other things. Right? So I saw this immediate kind of relief at an event, a week-long set of talks I did a couple, summer and a half ago, with a progressive Christian church up here on just north of campus. They did a week-long retreat, and they were talking about the environment and politics and religion, and so I came in to do some talks. And I went through some of this framework, and then one of the people said, hey, would you come talk to the youth about this? Because I think they'd be interested in it too. So youth defined as kind of high school and younger. So I went and talked to them, and they were really intrigued by it. And so then one of the pastors said, hey, would you mind kind of bringing us all together and talk to us all about this at the same time and allow the youth to kind of offer their views and have everybody else just listen to them? I said, sure, yeah, that sounds fine. So what I did is I took about 15 youth and put them in a semicircle up front, just in a room like this, except they were up on a little bit of a stage, and had a group of probably about 150 older adults, maybe 40 and older for the most part, who sat out in an audience, and I turned my back to this audience, and I said, I'm going to talk to these youth, and you all get to listen, but you don't get to talk. Okay, you just get to listen. Well, you were there. And so in this moment, I was just going through this framework, and this one girl was talking about this everyday activity and the importance of recycling and what it meant to her. And she was like 15 years old, and she was saying, well, you know, I just really think that recycling is every bit as important as voting or anything like that. And so I'm just talking to the youth. And then behind me, though, I hear a woman stand up and say, what? You can't really believe that. Okay? And I, of course, was intrigued by the fact that she felt compelled to say this, right? And so I, being always protective of kind of the younger folks, that's kind of where my heart lies, I was immediately kind of turned around and ready to say, hey, just this isn't your moment, this isn't your time. But before I could do that, this young girl up on the stage said, yeah, I really think it does. I really think that that everyday recycling matters. And so then the woman in the audience shouted right back at her and said, so do you really think that recycling on a daily basis is more important or would have been more important than electing Al Gore to be president in 2000? So, you know, and I was like, this is interesting. And this young girl who was standing up here, so it's about me to you, same distance, said, yeah, do you really think that electing Al Gore to be president would have changed the system? I don't, and I can do something every day. That's what matters. And I sat there and I said, like, that's right. There it is, right there. The dutiful relational, right? And so I was like, well, that kind of captures it for me. This sense of power, where does power lie? For the relational citizen, it lies with them. Now, we all may in this room think that's a bit of a fiction involved there, but it's still an empowering space. So a distinction of kind of what it means to be a citizen is a set of everyday activities and a set of formal activities. And I kind of fall more on the everyday activities myself, even though I know the importance of voting. But sometimes my wife will have to say to me, did you vote today? And I'll be like, I don't know if it's going to really matter. She'll be like, you are a professor. You need to be able to tell your students that you voted. Now go. All right. But now I don't have to go, right? I can just do it with the mail-in ballot. It's a lot easier. I just copy what she does. Next distinction. Dutiful citizens tend to receive media. They passively wait for media to arrive. When does it most commonly arrive for a dutiful citizen? Roughly 6:30 in the morning when the newspaper lands outside their door, right? Or it arrives at 6 p.m. or 11 p.m. when they turn on the news in the evening. They wait for media. The relational citizen says, that's just crazy. The notion that you would wait for news or information to arrive, you know, I navigate media, the relational citizen says. I'm in control. I'm the one who's going to go and get information whenever I want. I'm empowered. I'm going to go with it. When I was a kid growing up outside Detroit, big sports fan, I'd have to go to bed often at night not knowing who won the games that I was interested in, who won the Detroit Tigers baseball game or hockey game or something. Today, the notion that I would ever go to sleep not knowing what the score was of a sports team I cared about is crazy, right? I mean, I take my phone to bed with me, okay? I do, so that I can, when, you know, like at night when you're reading before you go to sleep, I'm reading my phone, okay? I'm getting scores. I bet you if you ask people under the age of 20 if they sleep with their phones, a large number say yes. They sleep with their phones. Yep, it's their stuffed animal, okay? So they navigate media. When I wake up in the morning, as my kids are making noise and I get up with both of my boys, the first thing I do is I'm kind of waiting. They get dressed. The one thing they do is they get dressed. I kind of just sit there and I check the weather and I'm just kind of laying there with my phone. It's a very romantic moment, okay? All right, so I'm navigating media. Another point of distinction is that dutiful citizens tend to join. They join, they like come to lecture series. They tend to join churches, religious organizations, clubs, civic groups, political parties. And relational citizens want nothing to do with joining. They're networkers. They don't join, they network. the equivalent in our culture today of a relational citizen of a joining moment. So let me say that a little bit less convoluted. The moment of joining for a relational citizen is when they give you an email address for them. Because they know they're going to get emails if they give you that email address. They're giving you that's the equivalent of them joining some kind of organization. I'll give you my email or my Facebook. I don't think you give a Facebook address. What do you give? You just say, I'm on Facebook, whatever. I'll friend you. Exactly. So that's their equivalent of joining. They will not join in the same way. I talk to organizations all the time who keep saying, no one will join our organization. We got to figure it out. And I said, there's really nothing to figure out. People are not going to join your organization. And so you need to change your model. So City Club, which has been a longtime civic organization, is quite active in Seattle in very good ways, recently changed their model to away from joining because people just don't join. Lots of people come to their events, but they don't join. In fact, they found that they were pushing people away by asking them to join, all right? Because culturally, to join today is something different than it used to be to join something. Now, here's some more tension between the dutiful and the relational. The dutiful say, you're flake to the relational citizens. You're flaky, can't be trusted, you have no commitment. That's why you don't join. And the relational citizen says, the reason I don't join is because I don't want to buy into all the baggage of that institution. So I'm not going to join. And so the dutiful citizen says, oh, but you know, I'm a Catholic. You don't have to believe in everything that's a Catholic. And the relational citizen says, why would you join then? Why would you join? It's hypocritical, they say. It's hypocritical. So there's some moral positions on both of this. The joiner says, and I think there's some truths, that there's a bit of flakiness over here. There's just this unwillingness to commit to any long-term thing. And then the relational citizen saying, yeah, but it's hypocritical to kind of put my name on the dotted line for something. So we've got some tensions here, again, which are exacerbated or catalyzed, fueled by technologies, I think. Lastly, I want to talk about what is the kind of primary human motivation, I think you would say, driving human motivation for these two different kinds of citizens. And most of us are a mix of these, but we tend towards one of the other poles. For dutiful citizens in the United States, the primary motivation is they've been seeking security for most of their life. They were raised in the Depression, have lived through wars, civic and civil turmoil, have seen recessions, have seen and experienced Watergate, have experienced sexual revolutions, fought for different things. They're looking for security, stability. They're looking for something that is going to be there. Okay? That's just not the case for relational citizens, by and large. They've been raised in security. They've been raised since in the 80s and 90s and the 2000s. And with the exception of 9/11, they've had no moment where they've ever felt real fear. Real fear. So they're not being driven. Those generally affluent middle class and upper middle class folks are not being driven by a desire for security. Now, they want something different. They want something epic. Okay? They want to be great. And I can tell you that I see this in my students 24/7. They want to be great. They want to do something like Mark Zuckerberg has done. Okay? They want to be great. And they have been hearing for a long time how the greatest generation was great and how the baby boomers were great or not and how religious conservatives have been great for kind of peeling back things that they wanted to peel back in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. They've been hearing how all these folks are great, but these relational citizens, they haven't had a great epic moment until 2008. When they elected Barack Obama, the first African-American president in this country. And you'll never be able to take that away from relational citizens, that they got it done. They did it. You'll never, ever be able to say you never did anything that no one else has ever done. They did it. The only white population in this country that voted in a majority for Barack Obama, under 30. 66 to 32. In favor of Obama. Everybody else is 40-60 Obama McCain if you're white. It's amazing how different they are. They want epicness. And so this longing, this deep fundamental longing that is there, I think is intertwined in these technologies, this kind of desire to be part of something huge, something great. And being part of Facebook is one of the ways that they experience this. One of the ways that they experience this epicness. Okay? So these distinctions, a sense of responsibility, formal activities, you kind of receive your media and you join things and you're looking for security. Over here, the generally affluent Americans are raised in a culture of choice and selectivity. They're looking for everyday activities to manifest their citizenship. They navigate media. They're never really untethered from media. They're networkers who don't join, but they know a lot of people, and they want to be great in some kind of way. And so if you can somehow tap into those pieces, you have gotten into the relational mindset, and you can take them just about anywhere, and they'll go with you, and I've seen it. And it's part of what I love about them. It's part of why I want to go to Israel. I don't want to go to Italy. Italy's great. I want to go someplace that's epic. I want to go someplace that's epic. I want to go to the Wailing Wall. Well, my wife has vetoed all this. I'm just using this as a chance to rant a little bit, okay? So now I want to turn now to a couple indicators of this kind of relational element in our culture. And I could choose a number of different ones. I just have chosen three that I think speak to some of the dynamics that I've just talked about. So those different characteristics I mentioned, let me talk about three things that I think speak to this. Let's first look at news attention, how people pay attention to news in the United States. After the colon, I put on demand. That's what news is today an increasing number of Americans. It's news on demand. You get it when you want it. Okay? Let's look at some Pew data. It's from two different years. I'm going to start with 2008 data. And I've broken down by the age gaps that Pew gives me for this. And I want to look at whether it's just a simple question. People are asked, when do you get your news? And the response options are very simple. You get them at a regular times during the day, or you get them from time to time, whenever you want it. Regular times versus time to time. So the blue percentages will be the percent of people in each age group who say that they get news at regular times, and then the red will be the percent of people in each age group who say they get it time to time, whenever they want it. So let's see. Okay. This is what we call a generational technological divide. And it's a fundamentally different way of understanding and engaging with news. Do you wait for news and you go to certain people, or do you do what a term that has developed among scholars, do you graze, G-R-A-Z-E? Do you graze as a news consumer? Do you go and check the headlines? Do you have a Twitter feed that tells you things that are happening? Do you go and just check out the headlines to see what's going on, maybe click on this link, go on this, go to this blog, but you do it sporadically during the course of a day? I probably do it 20, 30 times a day. That's what I do. I'm a grazer. Okay? So I'm definitely over here. I'm in this age group, and I'm in the red big time. Okay? Now, that's 2008 data. Pew recently came out with the 2010 data, and I want to just show you the numbers for 2010. Same colors work the same way. The blue is the percent of people saying they get news at regular times. The red is the percent that gets it at time to time. And we'll see a little pattern across each of the age groups. So this is 2010 data. So in 2 years, every one of these age groups has gone to more of this navigation of media. In 2 years, we can look back in the 1950s and know that that was a communication revolutionary decade, because television went from being present in 10% of U.S. homes at the beginning of the decade to being present in 90% of homes at the end of the decade. That's an incredible growth curve for a technology. Well, we're in the midst of that development right now with the internet and the explosion of personal computers and handheld computers. So people now experience news a very different way than they did before. What does this inevitably mean? It almost inevitably, in my view, means you're going to have less depth of knowledge and much greater breadth. You're going to know about things, but much less of things. So you're going to be able to talk about everything from Lindsay Lohan there's something interesting going on in Wisconsin, to, oh, by the way, Barack Obama today decided they weren't going to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. But we're not going to really know what's going on with those pieces. We're going to know that they are going on. But we're not going to know what's going on, because these folks over here, when they wait for the news, they set aside time. They say, I'm going to give myself 20 minutes to read that newspaper. Or 30 minutes to watch television news. The folks over there, they're catching it on the fly. It's like parenting. You're trying to do things all quick, and so you just don't get quite the depth you want. You got to really set aside the time to make it happen. Well, news grazers, they're not doing it. So they get updates. It's headline news 24/7. This is one of the implications of a relational environment, I think. Okay. However, you don't want to be out of touch, because your everyday existence is part of core part of your identity. So you've got to be constantly in contact. One of the hardest things for me to do is to go and kind of like be out of email, internet contact for a couple days. I mean, it is painful. Okay. All right. A second indicator is a question that Pew Research asks, where it asks people, have you given a lot of thought to this election? Very simple question, yes or no. Have you given a lot of thought to this election? And Pew asks this always in October of presidential elections. So it's consistently asked, same question wording, in October of presidential elections. So here's the last four presidential elections. And I've broken down the age groups again by what Pew gives us. But I've arrayed them as they are in 1996, the percent saying yes to this answer, this question. So the percent that said yes, that I've given a lot of thought to the elections in 1996, is exactly what our stereotype would hold. That older folks given more attention to the election than younger folks. We got the slackers at the bottom, aren't paying attention, and you got the older, dutiful citizens, God love them, who are paying a lot of attention to the election, okay? So now, there's four different ages, each of them a different color. They're arrayed as they do appear in 1996. And let's just look over the last four elections, how people answer this question. So you got about a 25-point gap between the ages over here. You got about a 10-point gap between the ages over there. You got the 30 to 49-year-olds going all the way to the top, and you got the 18 to 29-year-olds doubling. That isn't just an Obama effect in 2008 either. You see in 2004 the level of an interest and engagement that's growing. So when you see something like this, and yeah, I mean, if you want to point to the midterm elections and say, yeah, but these young people, where were they? That's what they always do in midterm elections. And you didn't give them anything epic to get out there for. You didn't give them anything epic. You got to give them something epic. The Tea Party's trying very hard to give them something epic. I mean that quite seriously. They're trying very hard to give them something epic. So these are young folks that have engaged and paid a lot more attention to the most recent elections. There's something going on there, something really interesting there. So you can't really say that these relational folks are just flakes. Maybe they don't join. Fine. But it's not that they're not paying attention. It's not that they don't care. It's just you've got to get them in a certain way. So that shrinkage between the age groups and the upward push of the young people, very interesting to me. Okay? You can see that it wasn't in 2000. This is roughly corresponds to the explosion of the internet and recent technologies. All right, one more. Let's look at social views on same-sex marriages. Same-sex marriages, in my view, are sometimes I make predictions and there's no chance they're going to come true. Or it's just it's a coin flip. I thought that Green Bay would win the Super Bowl, but that was just a coin flip, right? But I did predict it, just so we're clear. But there are some things, though, that I have a real strong sense based upon research and my own engagement in politics and my own teaching experiences that this is going to happen. So you can write this into the book right now, that the next epic moment for relational citizens is going to be same-sex marriage nationally. This is the next epic cause of young people, all right? There's no doubt about it. So what I want to show you is a figure that is my favorite figure. It's not mine. It's a couple sociologists. It's an incredible graph because it brings together so much stuff. Lacks and Phillips are two sociologists, and they take every available public poll done in every state in the United States across 15 years, and they average them all by state and then break it out by age group to see support for same-sex marriage, legalization of same-sex marriage. Okay? So across the bottom and the top is the same exact scale, from 0% support to 100% support. It's the same on the top and the bottom. It's the same scale. On this right side are the states arrayed roughly, not perfectly, but roughly from least support to most support. So let's look at who's at the bottom of this. We got Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Utah, Tennessee, Kentucky, South Carolina, Louisiana, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, West Virginia. That's the South and Utah. Okay? So South and Utah, least support. Up at the top, who's up at the top? Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Hampshire, Maine, California, Washington, Hawaii, New Jersey. That's the coast, folks. Okay? So it's roughly arrayed by state. You'll see there's one or two places where it doesn't line up perfectly, but it very closely. And then they've broken it down by age. I love this graph. So percentages of support over 15 years of public polls by state, by age. Okay, so I'm going to start it, and then I'm going to stop it for a second. So that blue color, which is the first level of support by state, is 65 and older level of support. That's the first line going up there. You with me? First line. So they're ranging between 10 and 35% across the states. So we'll go the rest of the way. Every line represents a new generation. Okay? It almost lines up perfectly. So you got 65 and older, then you got 45 and 64, and then the X's are the average of everybody, and then you got 30 to 44-year-olds, and then you got 18 to 29-year-olds. This is what political scientists call generational change. That the grandest social attitude change occurs not within people, but across people. That within people, you can do your best. You can do all you can, but you're always bound by those set of conventions and norms at some level that you've been raised with. You can never fully shake them. But that others are raised with new assumptions about the world. I know. I'm definitely raised with the assumption of that 18 to 29-year-old group that equality is just there for everybody. This is just there for everybody. But talk to me about issues of race. No, I have trouble shaking those things. Because I'm raised with those sets of ideals that I come out of my upbringing. So the reality is that for young people today, gay marriage, same-sex marriage, is just a why not? It's a relational moment. It's a selective moment. It's something that they will choose to engage in because they have friends, they know people. And let's just draw one line here. If you go all the way to the top of this black line, you see the highest level of support among 65 and older in Massachusetts. Highest level of support, 35%. Come all the way down the line, and you find that it's less than the lowest level of support for any 18 to 29-year-old group. So 18 to 29-year-olds in Alabama, Mississippi have more support for same-sex marriage than 65 and older folks in Massachusetts. Okay? This is what generational change looks like. And it's really crazy for us to not think that for all the foibles and all the jokes and all the things that we can say about a Facebook, that it doesn't have some impact on people's conceptions of who others are, what matters to them, the things that people will say that are deeply personal in a Facebook kind of communication. Really, these social media are potentially revolutionary in that respect. Okay? So these are indicators that speak to me and say, you know, this isn't just a generational change. This isn't just people engaging with news differently. This isn't just young people thinking one candidate is really great and they want to get out in the streets for him. No, there is something deeper here, this kind of generational distinctions. And I'm increasingly convinced over the last 2 years that technology is part of this process. That it is not merely something that's over here and this change is happening, but no, that it's commingled together. That it is deeply intertwined there. Okay? And it's something I frankly haven't figured entirely out, but I just know that in a very personal note, that I don't have great relationships with many of my siblings, but we can text each other very effectively. So I'm talking to them, and I'm not picking up the phone to call them. But we have a relationship that maybe will grow. And even if it never grows beyond this, you know, we actually do text about some things that matter. So something's going on that I'm not quite getting, but I'm in the middle of it, and it's kind of interesting. Okay, so I'm going to go back to McLuhan and finish with him. So McLuhan is a very short but, to me, potent quote. He just says this. He says, "We become what we behold. We shape our tools, and then our tools shape us." Right? Television has done it. The printing press did it. Personal computers have certainly done it. Smartphones. I think it's much easier for us to see this dynamic when it doesn't involve us, when we're looking abroad or we're looking to Wisconsin or we're looking somewhere else and we're saying, wow, they're doing something interesting there and technology seems to matter to this. But, you know, in the United States, it's not really that big of a deal. I mean, we all know it somehow matters, but like McLuhan says, we're not really grasping it. We're not really getting it. And one of the things that I've done over the last few years is commit myself to try to understand it, to try to go to people who understand it. My students, I go to ask them, I try to understand this. What's going on? What's going on with the texting? What do you mean you sleep with your phone? What's up with that? All these pieces, and it, you know, I have found it extremely helpful to kind of listen to them, incredibly valuable to listen to them, because not for the first time, but for one of the first times, I'm on the older side of a generational curve. And I know that about music, because I don't get any of the music they like. But I also need to recognize how it is that the technology is not just about the content, but about how the way they entirely experience the world, the way they entirely experience the world. I was walking here, I'll finish with this, I was just walking here from the Ave, got off a bus, was walking through the snow, the incredible blizzard out there, And I was waiting at the light to cross, and some student came walking by, and he goes, "Hey, Donkey, what's up?" Didn't even break stride. And I look at him, and he's got his earbuds in, right? He's on the phone, and he says hi to me, and he keeps on walking. And I happen to know this kid. He was in a class, so I knew who it was. But this, I just looked at him, and I thought for a moment, man, that's pretty cool. All right? So that's what I came to talk about tonight. All right? Thanks. So what kind of questions we got? Go ahead.
So when you talk about the media that are below the line and above the line,
yeah.
The battle that's going on now about net neutrality, one could be a pessimist and say it's going to fall below the line.
There's no question that those, let me put it this way. The early media, the media below the line, radio, I should really only say radio out of those three, started out in a not dissimilar space to where the internet is today. Was much more freewheeling. Frequencies were in competition with one another. It all was a problem. It was seen as a problem by many because who controlled the airwaves became an issue. And so, famously, when the sinking of the Titanic in 1912, in the aftermath of that, because of all the chaos that happened around the airwaves, and false stories being told, and not being able to get help, and rumors spreading, the Congress came together and passed the Federal Radio Act in 1912 that put control of the airwaves in the hands of Congress and said you can only broadcast on radio if you got a license from the government. And they did that in 1912, and then they changed it to the Federal Communications Commission in the 1930s, and it's continued to be our regulatory body for television and radio ever since. Because of that, they consolidated power and access to those airwaves in ways that they relegated all quote-unquote amateurs to shortwave radio. Before that, it was much more freewheeling, a whole different experience. and then I changed it. It's possible that net neutrality will lead to that if we lose a kind of sense of Wild West openness on the internet, that it will consolidate in the hands of a small number of powerful behemoths. I think there's a decent possibility that that will happen if there aren't steps taken to make sure that there's open access and ease of access on the internet. The one thing I think that is different about the internet that is different than any other medium we've ever had, or at least seems to be different, is that there is an unlimited kind of space. I know we need an Internet 3 and an Internet 4 to make that happen, but the cyberspace environment does not require the means of money to begin production in the same kind of way. You can be, a blogger making a difference. Really, you can, without being an institution with a printing a big, large printing press and a distribution system of getting a newspaper out and all of this. So I think net neutrality is not a pet issue of mine, largely because I look at the internet and I see innovation after innovation after innovation. That's what I see there. So I see. Now, maybe this is quite possible, living in a very privileged space. I mean, that is true. I am definitely living in a privileged space. But what's quite possible is that because I am, I'm missing pieces that are, like McLuhan would say, you're missing it. You're missing the picture. It's quite possible. However, I'm far more, I've really convinced myself of the democratizing power of the internet. I have. I've really convinced myself of that. And that excites me because I don't know if it was in this room, but it was not that long ago, maybe a year and a half ago when I was giving the Seattle Arts and Lectures, and I said, I love the ability to determine truth and to figure out what's true. And people in here got really mad because they said, well, how do you know what's true? And I said, well, why did you ever listen to three people tell you what was true? I'd rather know. I'd rather try to figure it out myself. And the internet at least gives me those options. Yeah, so I don't think that, even if there's encroachment to some degree, I can't imagine it's going to be down to a small number of networks in the same kind of way we experienced television for 40 years. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. What do I think about what? WikiLeaks or truth? I think WikiLeaks has some social value. I'm a staunch First Amendment person, but I think that there also are issues of national security that have to be weighed in there. So it's not the same thing as free speech of someone who's been under the boot of a dictator. I don't see it as quite the equivalent. Releasing the cables of diplomats, I don't see as quite the equivalent of that. But if I'm going to err on any side, I'm going to err on the side of free speech. I'm going to err on that because I'm just one of those kind of people that says that, the sense of free speech that I might be crushing today might be you crushing mine tomorrow, right? And so I get concerned about that. So although there are clear national security issues with WikiLeaks for many different nations, I come down on supporting it, but I do think it's a more complicated matter than allowing people to peaceably assemble to voice grievances. I think it's a different, the speech is different. Yeah, I mean, there are certain forms of speech that are private and serve useful functions in that capacity. What I would love to do is to have a good conversation about that in our society, to have a really good conversation about it, instead of the very quick kind of space we go to of WikiLeaks is good or bad, and you're either a patriot or not a patriot, and you're endangering the U.S. if you read them and support them, and you're hating democracy, small d, if you don't support them. I mean, I just don't think that we have the space to have that conversation because what happens is it becomes politicized very quickly, and people begin to seize these acts and turn them into political weapons and symbols in a way that doesn't allow us to have a conversation. So my general take on it is that I support what Assange has done, but a kind of carte blanche across the mold without any nuanced thinking about it, that does concern me some.
I want you to talk a little bit about how you envision
I think it's far more likely that we're moving. So when you look at journalism, journalism in the United States, news in the United States, has had two dominant models in the United States in its entire history. One is the partisan press, and one is the objective press. And the partisan press existed in dominance throughout the 19th century, the 18th and 19th century, and got usurped and replaced by the objective press, seeking objectivity with the rise of progress. Yeah, in quotes. For any of you that are worried that I'm not putting that in quotes, it's in quotes. The mode of objectivity press came in and replaced it really with progressivism and the rise of science and the social sciences in the 1910s and 1920s. And then what we learned is that, and this is an empirical reality, that people will consume more news that they perceive to not be biased. So they will consume more of it. So it's a money-making approach, right? You make more money. There's some really interesting data on that, but it's pretty clear that that is the case. So I think that Fox News' economic model, the very successful return to a boisterous partisan press, is the economic model that's going to drive us forward more and more. Yep. And I think the Internet, by and large, will facilitate that as well. And so what we're largely moving into is a much more of a partisan press period, which, again, if you took a look at the majority of U.S. history, was the model. It was the model. People vigorously arguing for their positions and being just adamant through the news pages, where newspapers used to be organs of political parties. So it's not that we're going to die as a nation or a people because of that, but it does require a different kind of citizen approach to exist in that kind of environment. You cannot process media messages without a different eye when you have that kind of an oppress. You have to take into account the sources in a different way. You have to think about that more carefully. You have to think about whether this is Fox or this is MSNBC. And even if you happen to all agree with MSNBC, which is what a typical Seattle audience was skewed towards, the reality is that you got to take that with grains of salt too, okay? So the reality is that I think it demands, what I kind of like about the partisan press is that it demands more of us, I think, as citizens. It demands more intellectual engagement on our part. What I don't like about it is that it demands more intellectual engagement out of us, and I don't know if we're up to that, right? So I'll just finish with this thought. Part of the reason the partisan press did work so long is because a lot fewer people could vote when it was in its heyday. I mean, democracy would look a lot different. We'd have a really, really well-educated, propertied people if only white men could vote in this country still. So democracy looks a lot different when you let everybody vote. That's just the reality. You get young people who don't know what they're doing and only turn out some elections. You get others who want to vote by mail or don't want to do this. I mean, things just change dramatically. So what we're trying to do is mass democracy. Mass democracy. We're really trying to live it out in this country. In a 300 million plus democracy, in which media are our primary conduit to politicians. Now, India seems to do some of it pretty well. We seem to do some of it okay. But I'm not sure that I'm pretty darn confident that we are not prepared yet to move into a partisan press in terms of our citizen engagement, our levels of knowledge and information filtering, our ability to work through that. We're not there. But we're in the midst of that transition. I mean, Fox has only been on the air since 1996. And they're really the piece that's driving this shift because they've been so successful economically. So I think, you know, I'm 40. By the time I'm 60 or so, I think it's far more likely that there's going to be more Foxes around than there's going to be CNNs. CNN is barely hanging on as we know it right now. Okay, they keep doubling down and saying, we're going to be the objective news organization. We're going to be the one that everybody can trust. And people keep consistently telling them, I'm not really looking for that anymore. Not really looking for that. Yeah. Okay.
Technology, or whether they need guides. I can give an example of, for instance, I show my students, look up L'Oreal Corporation, see what they own.
Yeah. I think the so I don't know if y'all heard the question. She was asking about whether the college students that I teach are the, let's just say, typical 18 to 25 year olds, if they are if they need their hands held in terms of how to effectively, in a positive citizen way, use engage with the different technologies, or if they're kind of just if they don't know how to do that kind of critical research or critical thinking. Because you teach junior high, and some, and a lot of those students are still needing kind of the leadership that you provide, right? My take on that is that that most of my college students still need that leadership. Yeah. And I think that it's an amazing thing that you go around this country and very few high schools teach critical digital literacy skills. Very few. And yet this is the oxygen that these kids are breathing. I mean, this is what they're on. They can. This is the drug of their generation. You know, we have the Just Say No to Drugs. We have all kinds of educational things, and yet we don't have classes in high schools, by and large, outside of really affluent ones generally, that are teaching kind of critical thinking about digital literacy. So we do this. We do this here, but there's a good chunk of us who feel like, man, it's almost kind of too late to do it in college. It's a little bit too late. At the same time, I also you know, have great hope about younger generations because they're incredibly savvy and potentially cynical, but aware of the way, some of the ways the world works. If they, once they do grasp this, once they do get this, once they do get it. So I'll just put in a little plug. We the Department of Communication has something we've created called the Seattle Digital Literacy Initiative. Okay, and it's taught by it's headed by a couple of my colleagues. A group that's a nonprofit group called the Common Language Project. They're a group of 320-something journalists who raise money to go cover underreported stories around the world and then come back and sell their products to news organizations. And they're really good. And they also work, and they also have a strong media literacy bent to what they do. And so they've created several partnerships between schools in other nations with schools in Seattle and to talk about issues they've covered. And so right now, from January through May, they're going into about 60 junior high and high schools around the Seattle area doing units on digital literacy using contemporary issues of the day. And then this summer, in June, at the end of June, we're going to have a one-week institute in the department where we'll on campus where we'll invite these students to come and to be exposed to education and discussion and also the production of content tied to this. And we're not sure if we're going to charge for it or not. We really want to make it open to everybody, but we got to cover costs. We haven't figured that all out. But we've launched this and we have a lot of support from different organizations around town. So if you've got young people, you might just Google it and check it out. But it's something that we believe very strongly in, that we need to be out of getting to the people before college. Yeah. No, you don't get two, sorry. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Why weren't telephones on my graph? I thought I actually wrestled with that. And I had it on there at first for a while, and I took it off. And the reason I took it off is because I was looking at the technologies that fundamentally created something new. And a telephone, in my view, was an extension of telegraphy. It was the ability to send sound through cables. Okay, so telegraphy was da 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 da. So it was just the difference between voice transmission and that. So it's the same ability, though, right? To send sound across space and time. That's why I put personal computers up there, but we've had desktops, we had mainframes, desktop, laptops, right? But they were all of the same genre. So I didn't put telephones on there because I didn't see it. When you look at the kind of invention, they're so closely tied in terms of the ability of what they did, that just didn't. It just seemed to me that it wasn't worth calling it a new technology. Telegraphy did the same thing. It connected a couple people sending noise to each other. Yeah.
The only difference I would see is just the nuance of voice and tone.
Absolutely.
And also, when people have been an observer of a particular event, the way they would talk about that might be quite different than the way they would talk
yeah.
about it. So, anyway.
Yeah, you know, that's... It's interesting. People who've done research on the Telegraph, we actually have a faculty member in our department. It's not a growing area. People research on the Telegraph, but we have somebody in our department, Richard Kilbowitz, who's done work on the post office, which is a fascinating thing to look at culturally in the United States, how it's been tied to politics over time, and the Telegraph. And on the Telegraph, there's all kinds of nuance that we don't recognize today that went into the Telegraph. It would be speed. Okay, pauses meant a lot of things. There's all kinds of things that just we humanly create meaning to, right? So no, not near as much as it would be conveyed by voice. But I would not be comfortable saying there wasn't any of those dimensions, right? Very few young people today have phones that are landlines. They increasingly have just cell phones. So one of my graduate students made a joke about our students this past quarter, in which she said, yeah, well, you know, someday they're going to wake up and they're going to say, I keep losing my phone all the time. Maybe I should get one that permanently stays. maybe it mounts on the wall or something, okay? And they're going to call it the stay phone, okay? So maybe one more question, okay? Yeah.
Technology. I often find myself wondering if our embrace of technology is not somehow making us less human in the sense that we are becoming more and more of the mind and less of the body.
Hmm.
And that's a question that gets into psychology.
Yeah. So my reaction to that is my thought that comes to mind in response to your question about are we losing some important senses of self and humanness, right, with the embrace of the 24/7 technology, I would go to something that I've heard Hanson Hossain, who spoke last time to you guys, has said, and I don't know if it's his thought or if it's the thought of all of the kind of thought leaders in our digital media program. Of which you're going to hear from Scott Macklin in a couple weeks, and Anita Vernacross is here tonight. You'll hear from her in a couple weeks. And I hear them talk about this point, that in this age of 24/7 technology, that we actually place a greater premium on the face-to-face than we ever have, because it takes on this magnitude and this meaning, and it is the full sense of human, the whole senses are all connected, right? So I can see you, I can hear, if I can see, and I can hear, if I can hear, and I can smell, and I can, all of these pieces. And so that there becomes this inverse kind of power to the face-to-face that occurs in this technology-ridden world, right? And I have found that to be the case in many of my, in my kind of being a department chair. I'm not someone who really thrives on a lot of meetings. I kind of like to spend time thinking. I get my energy from being by myself. But I spend an enormous amount of time on email. Enormous amount of time. I've finally convinced myself that I'm not wasting time on email, that I'm actually chairing. I'm being the chair, answering all these questions, dealing with all this stuff. But I have found this interesting dynamic that I actually have come to like seeing people. In a way that before I dreaded them because they were energy sucks in my life, right? Because as an introvert, you're always